We're talking with Nicole Perlroth, the author of This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends, the book about the cyber war underway right now. As we have learned in reading this book, hackers are always on the lookout for weaknesses, back doors that would allow them to penetrate a system. And when they discover such weaknesses, instead of using it themselves, hacking something themselves, they often put the information out on a thriving black market. And governments and corporations and criminals all want this kind of information and pay big money for what are called 0 days. That trade, that black market, is at the heart of what Nicole describes in her book. And we are going to jump into that part of the story in this upcoming segment. We'll be right back. Nicole, before the break, we were talking about the U.S. and Israel unleashing Stuxnet, which targeted the Iranian nuclear program, and it worked, but then it backfired.
Yeah, that's right. So, where I mention it in the book is that it was the most sophisticated attack the world has ever seen. And it was, like I said, just a bloody masterpiece. It was the first time that a nation state, as far as we know, have leapt into another nation's critical infrastructure, in this case, Iran's nuclear plant, and jumped from its window systems into the actual industrial controllers that controlled the speed of the rotors that spun its uranium centrifuges. And in some cases, it spun them wildly out of control, and then it would sit back for 27 days and do nothing. And then it would go in and it would slow them down to a trickle, and then it would sit back again. And all the while, when Iran's engineers looked at their screens, everything looked like it was running smoothly, when in the backdrop, we were destroying something like 1,000 of their centrifuges. So it was incredible. You know, it kept Israeli jets on the ground. It kept us from getting dragged into World War III. It kept more American soldiers from being sent home in caskets. But when it got out, you know, what it showed Iran and what it showed nation states all over the world was the destructive power of code. And since then, that was, when it got out, it was 2010. Since then, almost every nation state on Earth is stockpiling the code to both spy on its adversaries and conduct surveillance, but also in many cases to develop their own cyber weapons for a rainy day. And a lot of these cyber weapons rely on capabilities that are now developed, bought, and sold on an underground market where governments are not regulators. They are the biggest customers. So there is a invisible, unregulated market for the raw material that make up cyber weapons. And that market has allowed nation states that wouldn't otherwise have the capabilities of the U.S. or some of our closest allies to essentially catch up in terms of capabilities.
0 days, right? That's what that's the term for it?
That's right. 0 days are just the holes, like I mentioned before, in software that a manufacturer like Microsoft or Apple or Google don't know about. So if I, a hacker, find a 0 day in your iPhone's iOS software, and I know how to develop the code to exploit it, I could essentially theoretically use a 0 day exploit to spy on your text messages, track your location, turn on your audio on your phone, turn on your video camera without you knowing about it, access all your contacts and appointments. And really, what else does a spy agency need? So a 0 day exploit in your Apple iOS software these days, the going rate for that on the market I just mentioned is $2.5 billion, according to some pricing listed by a broker in the United States. And then in the course of researching my book, I discovered another broker called CrowdFence, which exclusively serves the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia. And they'll offer hackers $3 billion for that capability. So in a sense, we're getting outbid in this market. But yes, zero-day exploits have essentially become the blood diamonds of the cyber arms trade.
You were able to pierce this to a degree. You got some of these black marketeers to open up. And as you describe in the book, in very shadowy but colorful details, you have these furtive meetings where they would actually be in danger if some of their colleagues knew they were talking to you, right?
That's right. I say it's like Fight Club. The first rule of the zero-day market is no one talks about the zero-day market. And the second rule of the zero-day market is no one talks about the zero-day market. Anyone who has talked about this market has basically immediately seen their business plummet, because what you're dealing with is code that logically entails that no one can find out that you have found a flaw in these systems. Because the minute the minute word gets out, the minute a manufacturer like Apple discovers there's a flaw in their iOS software, they patch it, they roll that patch into a software update, you get prompted to update the software on your phone, and then it's fixed. And so that $3 million investment that brokers on behalf of Saudi Arabia and UAE just spent $3 million on suddenly turns to dust. So no one talks about this market. I was able to go back and find one of the market's first brokers, and I had to change his name in the book. But what he told me was in the 90s, U.S. government agencies, not the NSA actually at first, they didn't need outside help. They boasted some of the brightest, best engineers and hackers in the country. But other U.S. government agencies needed help, finding zero-day exploits, developing their cyber weapons. So what this broker told me was that originally they were finding zero days, and they would bake these zero days into click-and-shoot tools for U.S. government agencies, mainly for espionage. And this was the 90s. We were caught off guard by the U.S. embassy bombings, and then, of course, 9/11 happened. And, this was the end of the Cold War, and enemies were popping up in places that we never expected. And our answer to that was to try and spy on as many different systems as possible. And to do that reliably, the best way is to use a series of zero-day exploits. So what this broker told me was that in the beginning, he was finding zero-days, baking them into these tools, selling them to U.S. government agencies, and eventually came to this epiphany that, why should he spend half his time searching for zero-days and all this software when there are hackers all over the world? Who were always looking for holes in software. And so he started going out and approaching hackers in Eastern Europe, across Europe and Israel, some of them, as young as 16 years old, he told me, and offering them something like $90,000 to $150,000 just for the zero day. And this was in the 90s. And then he would take what they had found and go back to his lab, and essentially his team would develop this into a reliable espionage tool for the Pentagon or other U.S. spy shops. So started in the 90s, and then after 9/11, that really hypercharged this market. Suddenly saw zero-day brokers and developers popping up all over the Beltway. And after Stuxnet, you started seeing huge demand from foreign players. And these days, like I said, there are a lot of governments out there that are outbidding the United States in this market for zero days and zero day exploits and the tools that make up cyber weapons and surveillance tools.
The vulnerability is amazing. I mean, as you detail in the book, Yahoo, Google, Microsoft have all been targeted multiple times. Bill Gates comes out with a statement that you relate in the book about how cybersecurity becomes the top priority for his company. That was in 2002, so he could see what was coming. Government agencies, the NSA included, our best and brightest on these topics, they get hacked, their tools get stolen. It seems like everything is vulnerable.
Everything is vulnerable. Unfortunately, when the internet was created, it was created for openness, accessibility, convenience, speed. No one ever thought that we would be attaching our power grid and our hospitals and our medical devices and our homes and our bodies to this thing. And there will always be vulnerabilities in software, especially if we are creating it the way we are now, which you know, for the most part, we still follow the mantra that was vocalized by Mark Zuckerberg in Facebook's early days. Move fast and break things. Get your product to market first. Keep shipping. And unfortunately, speed has always been the natural enemy of security. So we don't incentivize companies to stop and slow down and think about the ways that their software could be hacked before they roll it out into the market, into our cars, into the power grid. And, you know, a lot of critical infrastructure in the United States is now digitized. And the problem there is that something like 80% of U.S. critical infrastructure is owned by the private sector. Some of those private companies like PG&E have the big budgets and resources to secure their systems, to monitor for intrusions, to essentially hire these mini intelligence units to monitor for nation state threats. But a lot of them are, the majority are not PG&E. They are small municipal water treatment facilities that have to rely on networks of outside contractors or supervisors to make sure that the temperature and pressure and chemical levels are all functioning normally from remote locations far away. And that remote access can be exploited by hackers. So everything has always been vulnerable. The problem is we're now hooking up these vulnerable systems to our most critical infrastructure, and we're not giving those people or companies the incentives to actually secure those systems and make sure that they can't be abused by nation states. And nation states have seen that they have a huge asymmetric advantage in cyber. They will never be able to match the United States militarily in terms of our military budgets and might, but they've learned that they can do a lot of damage by hacking us with cyber attacks. You know, North Korea has basically been able to skirt sanctions by hacking Bitcoin cryptocurrency exchanges. They pulled off a heist at a Bangladesh bank and ultimately stole $81 million. I think it was the biggest known cyber heist that we've known about in history. You know, Iran has hacked Bank of America and Citigroup and all of these banks' websites. They've pulled them offline by flooding them with traffic. That's not a sophisticated attack, but it got the job done. And so we see this over and over and over again, that nation states see that we have a very soft underbelly here in the United States. And so we are still the most advanced player in terms of cyber offense. No one has pulled off anything close to Stuxnet since that was discovered in 2010. But what people don't realize is we are also the most targeted nation in the world by hackers. And we are also the most vulnerable because we are so digitized.
Is there any kind of classified or otherwise intelligence assessment that would describe sort of worst case scenario? Russia unleashes the all out cyber attack, maybe China at the same time, or Iran, North Korea. What would happen here? It's not just losing your computer or having people access the sensitive private info in your phone. I mean, worst case scenario, it could be really bad. And I, as you said, Dick Durbin called one attack an act of war. Could it get to the point where we react in that way, that it was an act of war and we respond with force?
Yeah, I mean, we have run simulations over and over again that show what a cyber attack on our infrastructure would look like. And the best book on this that I can recommend for your listeners is actually called Lights Out by Ted Koppel. And it really focuses on an attack on the grid. And the grid is very vulnerable. But what saves us is that it's so decentralized. So to pull off an attack on the grid at scale would be difficult. Not impossible, but would be difficult. It's the same conundrum that our adversaries would face with an attack on our elections, which is that our elections are so decentralized that to pull off an attack at scale would be difficult. But I think actually people underestimate just how successful an attack on a key county in a swing state would be and how easily that could go unnoticed. But getting back to your question, you know, what I fear most is some kind of coordinated attack that uses some of the attacks we've already seen, just pulls them off simultaneously. So imagine an attack on the grid in a major U.S. metropolis, just like Russia already did in Kiev. And then imagine a ransomware attack on American hospitals that locked up all those hospital systems and kept them from accepting new patients. And imagine the worst case scenario, which is the one that keeps me up at night, which is the one we just saw attempted in Oldsmar, Florida the other month, an attack on a water treatment facility that contaminates the water supply. And that would really be a silent killer. So if you pull those three things off simultaneously, that is a deadly terror attack. You know, that could potentially cost more lives than we saw in 9/11. And that's the scenario I really fear the most. And those things are possible. We've seen each one of those attacks happen, not just once, but several times. And, you know, unfortunately, the way that we have reacted is to basically pull off cyber attacks of our own. You know, we have retaliated on some of Russia's attacks on our grid by hacking its grid. When we reported that the U.S. Cyber Command was hacking the Russian grid, we went to the National Security Council, my colleague David Sanger, and I, and we said, do you have any problem with us reporting this story? And usually we have these painful conversations with government agencies, but in this case, they said, nope, we have absolutely no problem with you publishing the story, which was just yet another signal that the U.S. really wanted these attacks to be seen by Russia as some kind of deterrent, as some kind of mutually assured destruction. And that is the place we are now. Adversaries are in our grid. We are in theirs. And, you know, the only thing we're waiting for is some sort of geopolitical trigger. And right now there's a lot of geopolitical triggers out there that could escalate. And I don't know what it will be, but they are, you know, we are steadily facing a situation where we could see a serious attack on our critical infrastructure.
I'm curious whether our leaders are reading your book. Are they getting the message? Is there any kind of behind the scenes, semi-desperate attempt to plug some of these holes?
There is. You know, there was this cyberspace Polarium Commission that was formed, and the co-chairs were Angus King, the independent from Maine, and Mike Gallagher, who's a Republican congressman from Wisconsin. And they did an excellent job calling out the problem. You know, all of the problems that we've essentially highlighted in this conversation. And they came up with some good ideas that there we should create incentives for companies to have better security, that we should penalize companies that have shoddy security, that we should have a bill of materials, some kind of system where we actually know what software is touching our network. When we discovered the SolarWinds attack, the Russian attack on our federal IT systems, when I called the victims up to confirm that they had been hit or, you know, see if I could gather more information, half of them didn't even know what SolarWinds was.
Wow.
So we don't even know what's in our network, let alone we don't know the open source code that makes up the tools that are in our network. So just getting a basic bill of materials to understand you know, what is powering our systems and how secure it is would be a great first start.
Nicole Pearl Roth, we're going to take another break, come back and talk more about your book, This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends. We're talking with Nicole Pearl Roth about her excellent book, This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends, about cybersecurity and the lack thereof around the world, in particular in the U.S., the vulnerability that our systems have. At the top of the program, I mentioned this news story where the NSA is asking Congress for permission to operate domestically. It is a weakness that's supposedly being exploited by foreign bad actors who come here and use the U.S. as a launching point for cyber attacks of some sort because they know the NSA is not supposed to operate here. We also know, though, of course, through the Snowden leaks that the NSA has collected a heck of a lot of information about American citizens, otherwise private information. We know about a variety of different arms of the national security state. I mean, private companies that now collect information on where our cars go and sell it to law enforcement agencies who don't need a warrant. Information that tracks our cell phones, information that facial recognition of where we are. You put all that stuff together and it's like total surveillance system. You know, I don't think it's paranoia to say that we should have concerns about that. It's a sort of another side of the coin of the cybersecurity that we're discussing tonight, because, you know, everything, as Nicola's told us, everything is hooked up to the internet in this country, even your toaster nowadays. So I want to jump into that, and then we'll open up the phone lines, take a couple of your questions for our guest in our final segment with Nicole Perlroth here on Coast to Coast AM. Nicole, I wasn't kidding or exaggerating when I said that your book is maybe the scariest thing I've ever read. It's just really spooky and sobering, and the consequences of cyber attacks and hacks are almost unimaginable. They hit us in every direction, and I could see a scenario where we or another country would respond and end up in a shooting war or a nuke war in response to what would seem to be an act of war in the worst case scenarios.
Yeah, I tell the story in the book about there was a point, I'm blanking on the year, I think it was 2013, when an Iranian hacker was caught mucking around the controls of a dam in the United States. And I interviewed Michael Daniel, who was Obama's cyber czar, essentially. And what he told me was that he got the proverbial 3 a.m. phone call from John Brennan, then director of the CIA, freaking out because the Iranian hacker was in the Bowman Dam. Now, it turns out we have two Bowman Dams here in the United States. We have the giant Bowman Dam in Oregon, which holds back a tsunami's worth of water. And if a hacker unleashed the locks on the Bowman Dam in Oregon, we would potentially be looking at a terrorist attack. But it turned out that actually the Iranian hacker was inside the Bowman Dam in New York. I think it was Westchester County, which was a dam that was under repair, so they couldn't have done any damage anyway. But basically it holds back a little babbling brook. There's really no water in that dam. So originally, they thought it was the Oregon Bowman Dam, and that would have necessitated an appropriate and equal response. And fortunately, they were able to discover pretty quickly that, no, they were just in this babbling brook and couldn't have done much damage. But that incident taught me that, you know, in this space where attribution is already pretty difficult, the potential for miscalculation is very high, much more so than in the kinetic warfare. And so, you know, that is really a very real scenario. And when I asked Michael Daniel, what is the thing that you worry about most when he was still cyber czar in the Obama administration, he said miscalculation. That was what he feared the most. Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about privacy issues for a second. You know, I mentioned there before the break about, you know, the Snowden leaks. We learned a heck of a lot about what the NSA was up to, this massive surveillance system, sucking up all the electronic data about communications here, private citizens. You add to that these stories we've been seeing over the last several months about private companies that now are able to track the movements of all of our cell phones, the private companies that can track the movements of where our cars go, the expansion of facial recognition software. You don't have to be as paranoid as I am to start worrying about where it all leads, you know, that other countries, foreign actors, hackers could access that kind of information. And not in addition, the NSA itself. I mean, I don't think that they're the bad guys. They're obviously our guys, but you allow them access to unlimited amounts of information, for example, and them asking for permission to operate here and to chase foreign actors here. Do you think that there's a way to balance those concerns?
Well, I think it's a really tricky predicament we're in right now. I think actually, to be honest, the Snowden leaks, I think, left a false impression that the NSA was watching everything Americans do. And I don't think that's the case. The NSA is definitely attacking any new commercial technology that comes on the market to look for holes, to look for ways that could potentially be used to spy on people abroad. But we are confined by a lot of red tape that our adversaries are not. The problem is, because of privacy considerations, because of the Constitution, the NSA isn't looking at domestic systems. They're not looking at domestic traffic. And that is now the sweet spot that Russia exploited in the SolarWinds attack, that China exploited with their recent attack. You know, when Russia hacked SolarWinds, they didn't do it from Russia or from Singapore or somewhere else where they might have staged the attack from. They did it from New Jersey. They did it using GoDaddy. So, you know, this is a really tricky predicament that the NSA is in. And I don't know what the answer is. I don't think that there is an appetite in Congress. I don't even necessarily think there is an appetite in the executive branch to do what it would take for the NSA to have caught that attack on our own systems domestically. And so where does that leave us? And I think where it leaves us is a place where we need to increase real-time threat sharing between intelligence agencies and the FBI and the private sector. That's something we've talked about for a long time, but we've never actually been able to do it in real time at scale. We do need things like a data breach notification law that requires technology companies and other companies to report breaches as soon as they detect them. Because oftentimes what you see with China in particular is if you're hit, chances are all of your competitors are hit too. They don't just hack one company, they hack large sectors of the economy. And, you know, for a long time, these companies' response to cyber attacks was to try and bury it. They're really worried about what it would mean for their stock price and their reputation. And the problem is that by burying it, you basically leave the rest of us vulnerable because unless we know about it, we can't do anything about it. So we have to work all of this out. And these are all things that are being discussed now. And if there's any silver lining to what we're seeing right now with this recent Chinese and Russian attack on our systems, it's that it has left the Biden administration no choice but to address this problem. You know, we've talked about it. We've talked around these issues for a very long time. We have no choice but to figure this out. And I don't think that there is a perfect solution. And I think it's this administration didn't just inherit IT networks they can't trust, because chances are, you know, Russia was in our systems for more than 9 months. Chances are they've planted many more backdoors that it will take months, if not years, to uncover. But they also, you know, inherited a mess of cyber realities that previous administrations just didn't adequately deal with.
Mitch, I agree with you that it should not be a partisan issue. And these computers, government agencies, they serve all of us. The grid serves all of us. So I hope they can get a handle on it. I'm just wondering, before I go to the phones, take some calls, do you have suggestions for just regular people? I mean, you have described in your own life, you know, you're sort of moving toward getting off the grid. Maybe it was circumstances that led to that. But, you know, is it hopeless for individual people to try to minimize their threat level or minimize any kind of being part of something like this where your whole life is basically online?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a good question. And the last thing I want to do is leave people feeling hopeless. I think for too long we've felt hopeless. And I don't want people to think that there's nothing they can do. I mean, I think you have to think about who would target you. You know, for me, it is nation states. It is cyber criminals. It's intelligence agencies. I really have to think about that in my work. My sources are the thing that people would really love to know about. So I protect my sources as best I can. You know, like I said, I use pen and paper. I don't bring devices to interviews. I try to limit any kind of digital footprint when I'm communicating with sources. I use Signal, the encrypted messaging app. You know, I won't even drive my car to certain meetings because I'm worried about the GPS in my car. being hacked. So, you know, for me, I have to think about a lot of these things. For the average American, you don't have to think about, you know, nation states or intelligence agencies trying to get what you have. So you have to think about what is the thing that you have that hackers probably would covet the most. For most people in the United States, it's your bank account and your email address, because your email address gets a hacker access to so many other systems, like your brokerage account, your mortgage, your financial life, your identity. So the best thing you can do, and it's boring and people are probably sick of hearing it, is use different passwords that are long for different sites and turn on two-factor authentication, you know, the process by which you get texted a second password if someone logs into your account from a strange device. If you're really paranoid like me, buy a YubiKey on Amazon, which is basically a more secure version of two-factor authentication. And don't click on links or attachments, and update your software updates when you get those annoying prompts on your phone and on your computer. Don't ignore them. It's all the boring stuff. And if you do all the boring stuff, you're going to knock out about 80 to 90% of the cyber threats you face.
You've been spying on
my... It will protect you from a Russian SolarWinds attack, but it will protect you from most attacks out there.
You've been spying on my digital life, haven't you? You know already all the things that I am reluctant to do. I'm just kidding.
Well, you know, I was even reluctant to do it at first. And then I had this incident where I got a call from a guy who's been quite helpful, but he happens to have a Russian accent. And he said, I just discovered this trove of a billion passwords, and yours is in it. And I know that your password starts with this letter and ends with this number. And I was like, wow. Oh, God, oh, I really have to turn on two-factor authentication and change all my passwords. Yeah. And that was 10 years ago, and I've never looked back. But yeah, it's annoying, and you can get a password manager, and it makes it easier, but it's all annoying. And unfortunately, until passwords go away, we're stuck with the system.
What about quantum systems? How does that change the whole dynamic? Quantum computers, is that supposedly...
In the Snowden documents, there were references to some quantum breakthroughs, but they never actually illustrated what those might be. Like I said, you know, once there is a real quantum breakthrough, that is going to be the domain of the NSA, of really sophisticated nation states. That'll change the game substantially. I can't even think that far, because right now there's so many low hanging fruit.
Yeah.
Right now, it doesn't take a quantum breakthrough to break into your email account or into even our power grid or our nuclear plants. That's all entirely plausible and capable right now. And our adversaries are doing it. So let's just start there. And secure those systems before we worry about what quantum technology is going to bring us.
Let's take at least one call. First-time caller, Stephen in Indiana. Welcome to Coast, Stephen. You're on with Nicole Perlroth. Oh, he's gone. How about Brendan in Austin? Hi, Brendan.
Hello, thank you. I'll make it super quick so other people can get on. Why do you think we're spying on other countries? In Germany, they found a bunch of spyware we had put on... in their computers. Why do we put spyware on our allies? It seems like it's going to make them trust us less. Like, oh, we both realize we don't trust each other.
Yeah, that was embarrassing.
It's a great question. Yeah, I think, you know, the most damaging revelation from the Snowden leaks was the revelation that the U.S. was spying on Angela Merkel's cell phone. You know, she is one of our best allies. Why were we spying on her cell phone? Because that is considered fair game in the realm of nation-state espionage. We spy on Israel. You know, they spy on us. So there are complicated dynamics at play. But it's a great question, and I think the damage from that one revelation, is substantial. And I think, you know, we still have a close alliance with Germany, but I would have loved to be a fly on the wall in some of those conversations between Obama and Merkel when that was revealed. And, you know, the thing about cyber is that it just makes it a lot easier to spy on everyone. And I think the question we've been asking ourselves is, can we spy on this person instead of should we be spying on this person?
Right.
Same thing with, you know, can we hook up our power grid to the internet? Sure. Should we be hooking up our power grid to the internet? Probably not. So, you know, there's a lot of backtracking I think we have to do in this domain.
I think Bill Gates should pony up some dough, buy copies of your book that go to every member of Congress and their staffs and heads of most American corporations so that they're all aware of just how threatening this is and how damaging it could be if you don't pay attention to it. Nicole Perlroth, this is a great piece of journalism, and I hope people read it and remember it. And you're welcome to come back here anytime at all.
Oh, thank you so much, George. I have to say that I loved your interview with Ben Schneider last night. I rarely stray off beat because I have my work cut out with me with cyber, but one of the few times I did it was to go interview Ben Schneider and talk about the alternate reality he's created with Lord Huron. So I'm glad to hear you're a fan too.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much. This is How They Tell Me the World Ends is the name of the book. Folks, take a look at it. And Nicole, I hope we talk to you again. Bye.
Me too. Good night.
Good night. We'll be moving on to Adrian Rudnick, The Assessment,